nice to be down here and hanging out with desperate people. That's one of my favorite things to do on any Friday night, and most Friday nights I do, so that's a safe place for me to be. I live in Oakland, and I've been there since 1981, and that's mostly where I go to meetings. I travel out a little bit to other places, and but mostly I hang out there. It's safer. there's visitors, and there's some newcomers, and I'd like to welcome you all. It takes a while to get used to AA, because we do things very differently, and I'd just like to explain a little bit about that. When we were 50 years old, back, 10 years ago or so, it was a great big deal. All the news coverages were about AA, and the McNeil Lair News Hour spent 20 minutes on us, and there was a big write-up in the New York Times and Time and Newsweek. I mean, it was a big deal. And the news folks went to New York and talked to the folks that run AA in New York. And they said, how many members are in your fellowship? And they said, sometimes 1 million. Sometimes 2 million. We aren't sure. It's frequently higher in January. Numbers kind of drift off around July, so. And they said, so you don't keep records? And they said, no, we don't keep records. And they said, well, we've heard that some very famous people have gotten sober in AA. And they said, we've heard that too. Don't you have a list of prominent recovering people? No, we don't do that. We found that that's not good for people like us to know those things. And they tried to explain a little bit about anonymity. And the press doesn't get anonymity, And the notion that principles are much more important than personalities is something that needs to get talked about a lot. If you like everybody you've met in AA, it's a sign that you haven't been to enough meetings yet. Because there are some very cranky, difficult people that come to meetings, and this is how the traditions develop. The traditions develop because we don't get along. And so we have to have some way where those of us who are crazy and those of us who are impossible and those of us who are irritable can all function together, or we're dead meat, So through trial and error and grace and human experience, we've developed some kind of program that works for people like us, who tend to be cranky and tend to be difficult and tend to have egos as big as all outdoors. So welcome, also, one other thing that's different about the fellowship. You're a member when you say you are, and you can't be thrown out. What kind of a group is that? If you weren't real clear on this, if you're a visitor from the outside, the impression you might have is that they get the real well people to share at meetings. Spokesperson for AA, Picture of Mental Health, said, And what we've discovered is that's not good for us either. If someone who is totally spiritually evolved speaks, the whole group gets depressed. However, if you have whiny, self-obsessed, damaged, crazy people share at meetings, everyone relaxes and says, oh yeah, me too. So it's interesting how hope works in meetings. So I am not up here as a role model. I just want to say that real clearly. Also, you don't have to agree with anything I say. My sponsor phrases it this way: each one of us has one share of stock in the program. We are equal owners. Each one of us has one share of stock. The highest rank you get to be in AA is sober. There's no more sober and less. I mean, you're just sober or not. And I'm not up here as a role model. We'll get along a lot better if you look upon me as a warning. And so you would leave saying, oh, I thought I was crazy, but then I heard the speaker, and I'm doing pretty well. You know, that's how it works a lot. So, and this is disagreement. You can disagree with me on stuff. You don't have to throw me out. I don't have to throw you out. And if you do disagree with me on things, you don't have to tell me about it at the end of the meeting. Call your sponsor. Talk to your sponsor. You don't have to tell me. It's a big fellowship. It's a big fellowship. And when I started coming to meetings, I had to hear someone repeat a lot, take what you need and leave the rest. Take what you need and leave the rest. Take what you need and leave the rest. Even if you do that stupidly, that's how you have to do it. And I needed to know that I had the room to take what I needed and leave the rest. I did not come into AA real comfortable. I was pretty much on the edge and pretty frantic. So I took a lot of stuff that I needed and held on to it real tightly. And that lasted for a long time. And then I found with a little bit of sobriety, I had to make some changes and some adaptations and change my program because life was different. I wasn't 90 days sober anymore. You know? I heard someone once explain it this way, you know, I mean, what's the difference in the program? You know, well, your first year of recovery is physical, and your second year of recovery is emotional, and your third year of recovery is spiritual. I've heard that thumbnail description a lot all over the United States, and I think it's a good one, but the question that comes up is, what do you do in your fourth year? You know, I mean, you've handled the physical, the emotional, and the spiritual, and now what do you do? Well, now you judge others for many years, and, you know, feel fabulous about it. My suspicion is this. I think the person that came up with that first year physical, second year emotional, third year spiritual, had 4 years. And my experience has been that my first 10 years were physical, my second 10 years were emotional, and now that I'm in my third set of 10 years, I'm hoping to fall into spirituality any moment. You know, it hasn't happened yet, but it may by tomorrow. And in my case, my recovery has been very, very slow. Some people have sudden dramatic changes in their life. I am not one of those. I'm one of those people who believes that slow is real, and that real things take time, and it just takes a long time for some of us to heal. And that's still real true for me. What was it like, and what happened, and what it's like now? Well, I grew up in the Santa Clara Valley, and let me give you some statistics so you can place me properly in your brain bones. I was born in 1947 in San Jose. I graduated from high school in 1965. I got sober at the age of 29 in 1976, and I'm almost 53 years old. So just to kind of summarize those things. So that's a long time. And there's a lot of alcoholism in the family, and we never talked about it, ever. We're pretty traditional Americans. My mom is born and raised in Sweden, so she's a pretty much new immigrant. My father's parents were both from Ireland. They came to San Francisco, and my father's father was the chief gardener at Stanford University for a long, long time. And my father was born in San Francisco in 1904 and was there for the earthquake. When he applied for a passport after he retired from work, they went to get the documents of place of birth, and there's a big stamp on it that says all of his birth stuff was destroyed in earthquake and fire. That's what it says. So I think that's kind of wild. On my mother's side of the family, which is pretty much Swedish Lutheran Republican, we never call them alcoholics. We refer to them as being nervous people. And literally, I would have cousins who were hospitalized for nerves. And then, they'd dry out. My cousin Per, we really are Swedes, Per, P-E-R. Per comes out of the hospital, and he's pretty steady, and he just starts slamming back Coors like it's going to be, made illegal. And he has a bad session of DTs, and we refer to it for years afterwards as his nervous spell. And when he was in his 60s and 70s, he completely lost his memory. He couldn't remember anything, and they wondered why. And I said, well, if you soak your brain in a quart of vodka every day for 50 years, you forget details. And no one wanted to talk about that. But that's that. My cousin Howard was just drunk for years. He showed up to his mother's funeral sober, and no one knew what to do with him. It was just so startling. So that's that side of the family. On the Irish Catholic Democratic side of the family, we didn't call them alcoholics. We called them characters. And we would say things like, Sean is becoming a character, isn't he? Sean likes the pubs. He is a character, isn't he? Yeah, that's right, Mom. So that was how we made polite, I guess, and we never talked about it. Years ago, I used to say that alcoholism in my family was exactly like having a rhinoceros in the living room. Everybody knew it was there, but you also knew if you said, look at the rhino. Everyone gets mad at you because we were getting along so well until you came along. And you're the one that has to take it out, and no one volunteers for that job. So it's an interesting situation with the rhino. The rhino in my family slept a lot. My dad was a very nice man. And the pattern for alcoholic males in my family, he's very much in this. You hold down a job for years. You're real involved in school and church, also civic stuff, for years. You're a good citizen. You come home, you drink, you pass out. So I felt abandoned, but he never left home. This was very confusing for a while. He was, in 1948, I was a year old. In 1948, my dad was the chairman of the Dewey for President Committee for Santa Clara County. I think this is very funny. And he never got over Truman's reelection. He never got over Truman's reelection. And a couple of beers, and all of a sudden it was back at 1948, and that damn Truman. And we just kept revisiting the vomit over and over and over again, which is one of the nice things about being with alcoholics. Nothing ever changes. And I know I picked this pattern up. When I was drinking, I could resurrect stuff that happened 25 years ago as if it happened this morning and make it fresh. Nothing ever healed. I just kept it fresh. Gats. I started drinking really young. I liked it. I liked the sweet of cream de menthe. I liked mixing bourbon and Hershey syrup. I hear judgment. May I suggest that some of you have drunk worse? But that's little kid stuff. I was a small kid doing that. It was the sweet and it was the sugar and that pang of alcohol, which I've always loved. By the time I was in high school, I was not doing mixed drinks anymore because they were just a waste of time. I preferred vodka and I preferred gin, and I loved bourbon. I just thought it was such a nice way to go. I have all of the symptoms of alcoholism, blackouts, you know, where you're functioning but you don't remember much. I've had conversations with people I don't remember. I have driven places I don't remember. I've done a lot of things I just don't remember. And I think that by the time I was a senior in high school, I just accepted blackouts as pretty normal. I mean, they didn't scare me anymore. It's amazing how little scared me. They say you can't scare a drunk, and I think they're right. In my fourth step, doing that inventory stuff, it doesn't really mention this. It talks about resentments and fears and sexual stuff and finances. And drunk driving doesn't really fit under any one of those categories necessarily. Except looking back sober, it's the scariest thing I ever did. Years and years and years of drunk driving. And I rationalized that. I remember by the time I was 18, I was telling classmates of mine that there's no trouble driving while drunk. The trouble is just getting to the car. And I'd laugh, you know. But I'm veteran drunk driver, and I like mentioning that because it's one of those things that today, looking back, scares me the most. There was an old-time AA speaker, he's been dead for a long time now, named Norm Alpie. And in his talk, he says, a lot of his story is a matter of seconds and inches. Couple of seconds difference, couple of inches difference, and it would have been a real different story. And that's very true for me. So I'm grateful I'm not a statistic, and I'm grateful I didn't make anybody else a statistic. Also, a pretty classical sign of the alcoholism is the mood changes. We go from black to white so quickly. In the program, we refer to these as Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. Dr. Jekyll is the good guy, by the way, and Mr. Hyde is the bad guy, if you haven't gotten around to reading it. And if you want to read something that is terrifying and is not conference approved, may I suggest Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson. It's all about us. And one of the reasons it's a scary book is there's no recovery. Mr. Hyde wins. And it is a long visit with step number one. Well, I had Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. I also had a pretty good case of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. Where I would drink and I would become dopey or grumpy or sleepy or happy. Occasionally I would turn into Snow White, which was really very surprising to everybody, especially me. So I was sober a very short amount of time, and I was wondering if I was an alcoholic. I was very depressed and I was very crazy, I knew, but alcoholic, I hope that... I preferred to have a brain tumor or cancer. I remember going through a period I would have preferred that rather than alcoholism, because at least with a brain tumor or cancer I could drink. But with alcoholism I couldn't drink, and it seemed so unfair. And I went to the El Cerrito Fellowship. I got sober in Berkeley. Now, this is not a judgment, this is an observation. But there is no reason to ever go to El Cerrito. Ever. Unless you're looking for a meeting, then there's a reason to go to El Cerrito. It's an awful town. And if you're in the East Bay, and because I know geography gets fuzzy as soon as you leave Milpitas, it goes, you know, Oakland, Alameda, Oakland, Emeryville, Oakland, Berkeley, Albany, El Cerrito. That's how it goes. And it's very close to a BART station, and the old El Cerrito Fellowship had meetings all day long, especially for those of us who were jumpy. And on Friday nights and Saturday nights, they'd have a meeting at 6, a meeting at 8, a meeting at 10, and if you were still a little on edge, there'd be a meeting at midnight. And it was, there were any number of Friday and Saturday nights, a number of us just stayed for the meetings. Because it didn't fix you. I mean, meetings don't fix you, but they take the edge off. And that's what I needed, because there was no reason for me to go back home. There was nothing there. So I could stay at a meeting and stay at a meeting. So I was at the El Cerrito Fellowship. They had meetings. They also had old-timers all over the place. And may I speak candidly about old-timers now? And again, this is an observation, not a judgment. They're not always easy to be around. And many of them are as cranky as the day is long. However, if you can overlook their defects of character, you learn a lot. So we had these cranky old-timers, crusty, mean, snarly old-timers. That's how they looked. And then you'd sit down next to them and you would find pure gold. If you could get beyond the crusty and the scary and the snarly. And there were some old-timer women and some old-timer men that hung out at the El Cerrito Fellowship a lot, and they'd bump into people with 18 days, 26 days, 35 days, and they just listened to you. So I was pretty raw, and I was pretty new, and I was very jumpy, and I bumped into this old-timer, and I wanted to know how would I really know I was alcoholic? Because there could be a lot of other things wrong with me. And I said, how do I know? And he said, Tom, I don't know if you're alcoholic or not. I said, go on. He said, I only know that I'm alcoholic. I said, well, how do you know you're alcoholic? And he said, I know I'm alcoholic because I cannot guarantee my behavior after my first drink. I said, what do you mean? And he said, lots of times I could drink a lot and nothing would happen. No trouble, no problem, easy. Other times I'd drink just a little and anything could happen. And I never knew which one it was going to be. And that's my story. Lots of times I drank a lot and I never got into trouble. The drunk driving, I didn't get stopped. There were no accidents. It's not a problem, right? I'd be drinking in some awful bar. I'd get home. I'd walk up the stairs. I'd pass out in my own bed. I'd wake up the next morning, no vomit, no pee, success. Other times there were different results, and I never knew which one it was going to be. So I chose to believe I was alcoholic. I chose to believe I had this allergy, and I didn't know anything about it. And most of what I've learned here, and I've learned from other folks. I read a lot. I'm one of those people who reads a lot, and sometimes that's helpful and sometimes it's not helpful, but that's another subject. I was reading a book this past year, and it's a survey of treatment programs for alcoholism and drug addiction in the United States in the last 200 years. It's really interesting. And one of the points that the author makes is over the last 200 years, there have been hundreds, if not thousands of studies, examinations, articles, sermons, lectures given on alcoholism. All kinds of people have talked about alcoholism and addiction. Preachers and medical people and reformers and politicians. It's a great big part of the American story. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the first piece of literature written by us, for us. All of the other thousands of things have been written by other people about us. And it's a real different tone of voice. So the literature comes from the peer group, and I like that very much. I learn a lot about me when I can read the literature and pay attention at meetings. I come into meetings, I'm pretty depressed. How do I end up in AA? I'm intervened on. I had no particular trouble with step one. I've always been a little depressed anyway. So, and step one basically says, there's no way out, you're doomed. You know? It's not a happy step. I don't know of anybody who's taken step one gladly, you know. Most of us have to be beaten down to step one, and we're bleeding and on fire and still holding on, you know. And so I don't think step one is a happy step. I knew I was a mess. I knew there was no way out. I did a lot of reading that proved that. When I was in college, if you're in the seminary, you have to read a lot of philosophy. They want to try to get you to think a little bit, which is very hard. And so you read Greek philosophers and German philosophers and French philosophers and Latin philosophers, and drinking really helps getting through a lot of these guys. Sure helped me, let me tell you. And the French existentialists I love, there's a French writer of this century named Albert Camus, and he writes, the only serious philosophical question of the 20th century is why not kill yourself. And I said, yes, yes, finally someone has cut through the bullshit and is speaking the truth. And I read everything he wrote. In English, I mean, I don't know French, but I read everything he wrote, and I would carry his books around with me, and he spoke to me, because there was no hope there, and he spoke clearly that there was no hope, yes. And I'm, 19, 20, 21, 22 years old at that time. It's before my drinking got bad. Then there's another guy who did a lot of writing of this century, and he's Jewish and Hungarian, and he lives in Prague, and his name's Franz Kafka. And his writing is pretty bleak. And Kafka writes at one point, there is infinite hope, but not for us. Oh, yes! And this is my attitude when I come to meetings. I looked at all of you people and I said, there's a lot of hope for you people. You mean well. You're sincere. You're trying real hard. You're simple, but I mean, that's okay. I'm sure that this simple program can work for you. It's not going to work for me because I'm way too twisted, way too perverted, way too cynical, way too sarcastic to ever get what you people have. So I'm very glad for you, and I'm just going to try to hang out for as long as I can, but I'm not going to make it. There is infinite hope, but not for us. I think that's a step one place. Bill and Bob can, you know, Bill's sober, Bob's sober, they have to do something. So, they call the local guy in the hospital. I just love this story if I can find it. Oh, yeah. They call this guy. They explained their need. This is in the book on page 156. And inquired if she had a first-class alcoholic prospect. Now, I like bumper stickers that read first things first and easy does it and keep coming back. I would love to have a bumper sticker that read first class alcoholic prospect. I think that would add a certain quality to traffic. Or perhaps just buttons we could wear in meetings, you know, so people, a first class alcoholic prospect. The nurse replied, yes, we've got a corker. He's just beaten up a couple of nurses. Now, those nurses will have to go to Al-Anon or they will try to date him. Absolutely. We've seen this. Goes off his head completely when he's drinking, but he's a grand chap when he's sober, though he's been in here 8 times in the last 6 months. Understand he was once a well-known lawyer in town, but just now we've got him strapped down tight, which I would also like as a bumper sticker, is strapped down tight. I like that. And then Bill writes this wonderful line. Bill, he says, here was a prospect, all right, comma, but by the description, none too promising. AA has been founded for 19 days, and already they've raised the bottom. Bill turns to Bob and says, you know, Bob, when we got sober, we had a better quality of alcoholic coming in. Right now, it's just trash. Good Lord, he's a lawyer, you know. And if you go to meetings, you will hear old-timers exactly say that, how when they got sober, everybody was trying a lot harder, and now it's just trash coming into the fellowship. It's an old tradition for the new kind of that. Well, anyway, we all know that. So Bill and Bob go see this guy, and who are you? Why are you here? Said one of the visitors, we're giving you a treatment for alcoholism. And this is AA member number 3's first step. Hopelessness was written large on the man's face as he replied, oh, but that's no use. Nothing would fix me. I'm a goner. The last 3 times I got drunk on the way home from here. I'm afraid to go out the door. I can't understand it. That's right. That's step one. Yeah, doomed, trapped, no way out. I know of a meeting in Alameda County. In some AA meetings, we have a lot of rules. And in this one, the rule is, if a newcomer is present, you can only talk about step one. And I think that's because they don't want to give the newcomer any hope. You know? Then they wonder why newcomers don't come back. You know?
Well, all they did was talk about throwing up. Oh, really? Very attractive. Keep coming back.
When I was newly sober in 1976, there were people around. I haven't bumped into people saying this now, but there were people around that said they were two-steppers, not 12-steppers, two-steppers. They didn't like the 12 steps because they were too much hard work or religious or something, but they did steps 1 and 12, two-steppers. Step 1, we're miserable. Step 12, join us. For an hour, the two friends told him about their drinking experiences. They told him about their stories, and they're brand new, you know. They aren't preaching at him, they're not lecturing to him, they're just saying their stuff, and the guy identifies over and over. He would say, that's me, I drink like that. And then he goes on to say, from what you guys tell me, I know more than ever that I can't stop. At this, both the visitors burst into a laugh. This is the first recorded instance we have of inappropriate AA humor. You're not supposed to laugh in places like this, you know, but we do. I mean, and then I spent 25 years in solitary. We laugh. You think that's so funny? You know? Said the future fellow, anonymous, damn little to laugh about that I can see. And I would have that as the third bumper sticker right off this page. Just put it right there. I like that. I do believe that the great gift we give each other is our own stories, you know. And some people will identify and some people won't identify. My sponsor, who is a hopeless alcoholic of the worst kind, believes that You know you're in fit spiritual condition if at a meeting you identify with what people are saying. If you don't identify with what people are saying, you might not be in fit spiritual condition. He claims he has never been to a bad AA meeting, and I have told him he should travel around with me. I have been to some meetings, and I just hated everybody and couldn't stand anything, and full of judgment and upset. And what I've come to believe is that indicated that I was in trouble, not that they were in trouble. I'm a depressive drunk. I loved depressants. I loved being pretty sedated. I used alcohol a lot to sleep. A six-pack of beer was pretty much what I did before sleeping most nights. Dr. Bob, in his writing, says that he never had a headache in his life. I had very few. And I had very few hangovers. But I was a daily drinker, and most of the time I had no trouble with my drinking. Like a lot of us, I held down jobs. I mentioned that the males in my family, the alcoholic males in my family, work real hard and come home and pass out. I'm the difference. I would work real hard, come home, drink, and then get in the car. And I wanted to meet everybody in Southern California. I'm a loud, brassy, obnoxious drunk. And that's one of the reasons I got thrown into treatment at the age of 29. I was obvious. I felt real sorry for myself for a long time. Poor me, I can't drink anymore. I'm so young. I thought I was the youngest alcoholic in the history of the world that had to get sober. So I was sober a couple of months, and there was a California State Young People's Conference going on at Monterey. This was a big deal for me. I mentioned I was a pretty depressed drunk. Also, I was an isolated drunk. I drank in bars for a long time, and I was sociable for a long time, but I got over that. And then I could drink by myself in splendid isolation, where I spent a lot of time, and I didn't have a social life when I got here. And the thought of going to meet a whole bunch of new people was not my idea of a good time. But a bunch from Berkeley were going to this conference, so I went. And I really thought that I would stand out as being one of the youngest people there. And at this conference, this was in the spring of 77, there were about 1,000 people at this conference. And in the opening session, they asked, how many people are here tonight who are sober, who are not yet of legal drinking age? And about 40 people stood up. And the place went crazy, screaming and applauding and cheering. No. Yeah, that's the right response. And I came to the shocking realization that if the room had been divided in half according to age, I would have been on the older half. That was the first time at that conference I danced sober in my life. And I kept on expecting to fall down. There's a real different sense of gravity when you dance sober, as some of you may know. It's terrifying. It's like being on Nordic track. I mean, you're going to follow it. So, I was pretty depressed. I, no longer drinking or taking some other depressants, and I found that over a short period of time, I started waking up. I started coming to. And I'm not someone, who, like I say, who gets well fast. I don't come to pretty, and I don't come too neat. I'm real jagged, and emotionally I'm very raw for a long time. I think for the first 3 to 5 years of my sobriety, it was like the nerve endings had not yet grown back over my skin, and I'm pretty raw. I finished graduate school. I go back to teach, and I go back to Los Angeles. And I really have no tools. I mean, I know we talk about steps and programs. I have no tools. I'm going to meetings. I'm not drinking. I'm not using. Those are the tools I'm using. But I'm starting to wake up. Do you have a sponsor? Do you read the book? Do you do this? Yeah. But I really only have worked steps in emergencies. And then I become very good at this step stuff. You know, I'm just frantic. Right. Okay. Right. And then seconds after the frenzy leaves, I stop writing. I started my fourth step because I heard someone say at a meeting with that tone of truth in their voice that if you don't do a fourth step, you'll drink again. And that was motivation for me. So how do you do a fourth step? Well, you get the yellow pad and the right pen and the right book and all that stuff, and you interview people. How did you do your fourth step? And what I finally had to do was start writing, and I'm comparing this fourth step to that fourth step, and I want to, Hazelton has a book. Hazelton had a book on the fourth step that read like it was written by my sophomore religion teacher. And I wanted to hang myself when I read it. It was such an awful thing. So I mentioned that, and someone said, then don't use it. Oh. Okay. So I pretty much went by the book. I wrote about resentments, and I wrote about fears, and I wrote about sexual stuff, and I wrote about finances, which is talked about in the 12 and 12. But I was waiting for a spiritual moment, so I could begin writing my fourth step with clarity. And nothing would come, and nothing would come. I was in graduate school when I got sober, and you're supposed to do a lot of reading and writing in graduate school. And I'm sober now for 3 months, and I have a real big paper due. And what I discovered to my horror was I could not write sober. It wouldn't come. I had never written sober in my life. College, beer, typewriter, let's go. There was concrete in here. I found out that at 4 months sober, I could write sentences but not paragraphs. I couldn't develop thoughts at all. And I never knew if that would come back. Writing is still difficult for me, but I'm able to write now. But it was, I thought that part of my brain had been very damaged. But I'm trying to do some writing. Nothing comes. I go to an AA meeting. And what happened was there was a guy chairing the meeting that I took an instant dislike to. I've never seen him before in my life, nor since. But 4 minutes into his sharing, I despised him. And the more he talked, the more I disliked him. And I left the meeting in a white rage. I can't tell you anything specific. I didn't like his laugh. I remember that. Other than that, I remember nothing. In that fury, I went back to my house and began writing resentments. And his name was number one. And then people I resented. I just wrote the list of names, and I went as long as I could until I ran out of steam. And I had to wait until I was angry again before I could write again. So my fourth step took about 18 months. I could only write when I was very angry. Fear doesn't motivate me. I rationalize fear real easy, but anger gets me going. So one of the things I can do in recovery, when I'm angry, I can write. And I'm grateful for that. I also have learned that just because I write it when I'm angry, I don't have to mail it. Keep it. So the fourth step was really important. I learned a little bit about me, and I shared that with my sponsor. You don't have to. You don't have to share your fourth step or your fifth step with your sponsor, even if your sponsor says. The book says, what does it say? It says, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Some sponsors don't qualify. And when I've heard some fifth steps, and I've heard some fifth steps, it's real clear to me, I'm there as the other human being. I'm not there as God. You know, I'm not there to judge, you know, all. I'm just there as the other human being, and I just get to listen to folks. And I found writing and saying some stuff out loud helped me a lot grow up and stand a little taller and feel lighter. Some people do a fourth and fifth step and glow. I mean, they're just high from how wonderful the experience was. That wasn't my experience. I did it real business-like, real basic. But within a year of doing it, I was lighter. And I was seen to laugh without scaring people. It was a slow change. I was looking through part of the book. I like the stories in the back. And this is still on fourth step now. Oh, where is this? I've never memorized the book because it's written down. This is on page 292. There's a guy from Chicago. Here's their sober people in Akron. This is about 1937, 1938. And so he goes to Akron to meet all these sober folks, and he meets all the people. He meets Dr. Bob. I went to Akron last June. I did some workshops in Cleveland, and I found out that the distance between Akron and Cleveland is the distance between Milpitas and Los Gatos. I mean, it's real close. I thought it was hours away, you know. So I went to Akron a couple of times. There are people who want to turn Akron into Bethlehem. I think that's interesting. And I took the tour and I saw everything, you know, where Dr. Bob did this. And in Akron, Dr. Bob is just this huge figure. He is the source of AA. And they've heard of Bill Wilson, but in Akron, it's Dr. Bob. So this guy goes to Akron, and Dr. Bob spends a lot of time with him. And they go through the program. Dr. Bob led me through all these steps. At the moral inventory, step four, he brought up some of my bad personality traits. See, what we're used to is I bring up my own. Here, the other guy brings them up for you, which is called, I don't know, a little scary. But here's, you know, Bill Wilson's lister, resentments, fear, sexual stuff, finances. Here's Dr. Bob's. He brought up some of my bad personality traits or character defects, such as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentments. Now, when I read those this year, having, you know, been around for 20 plus years, that's the first time I ever noticed that list. And the reason it jumped off the page at me is this is much closer to my craziness than resentments, fear, sexual stuff, finances, bills for. Dr. Bob's list is my ongoing stuff around the defects of character needing healing. And when I have to promptly admit that I'm wrong, it's usually over selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, or resentments. And that's still ongoing stuff. So I was real glad to find out that that was in the book, and I found that helpful for my own understanding of my craziness. We're told in the East Bay that the reason the program works is we're not all crazy on the same day. But it's real important to know that all of us can get crazy. And I have days when you know, I need to be reminded of very basic things like, do we drink? No. Do we go to meetings? Yes. Thank you. And then I go to meetings and I don't drink. I try to keep it real basic. My sponsor was talking a while ago, and someone, you know, we in AA have such deep questions about everything, and we can go for a long period on questions like, what is God's will? I mean, very long meetings are on that topic. And I heard my sponsor say this about God's will. It is God's will for each of us to have a life. Go get one. Well, it can't be that simple. Yeah, it really is. You know? And I just believe that. And what I'm able to do in recovery is have some kind of life. And what does life look like? And that goes back to step two. Step two talks about being restored to sanity. And what I heard early in my recovery was sane people, healthy people, are able to do three kinds of things. Sane people can work. Sane people can love. And sane people can play. If you know somebody who can work, who can love, and who can play, you know a pretty healthy person. I had a shrink explain that to me once, and I said, well, you know, what does that have to do with me? And he said, well, with your alcoholism, it destroyed your ability to work. And it did. I was unreliable. Part of being a teacher in the state of California, they have this rule that says if the kids are in the classroom, you should be there too. And in all honesty, I can tell you that most of the time I was. But there were times I wasn't there and I rationalized it. You know, but, I mean, I was unique. I was different. I could show up late. I don't have to be prepared. I can leave early. All that stuff, bad teacher behavior. I had done it and I rationalized it. And I went back into the classroom sober. That was in my second, third, and fourth year of recovery. And those were the hardest years of my recovery. To teach sober, I had no idea what to do. The only tools I had to deal with the kids, the high school students, was sarcasm, resentment, fear. You know that list Dr. Bob had? That was my list. And that's how I defend myself. And I was real sarcastic with the kids. And I was very funny, but I was real sarcastic. And I, you know, looking back a little older and a little wiser, I'm horrified at my sober behavior professionally for a couple of those years. And we had teacher evaluations. And one of my students, a bright young man, he was a senior. He said, I like the material very much. But you have a way of making people feel real small, and I'll never take another class from you. Bingo. Clear example of the sober life, you know? I was scary. I didn't have any tools. I didn't know about restraint of pen and tongue. I didn't know that a lot of times I need to keep my big mouth shut. I didn't know how to handle emotions like anger and resentment. I was raw for a long time. And one of the things that happens with age and grace and recovery is we become a little less raw over time. I heard a guy from Orange County talk a few months ago, and he actually said something new at a meeting. I mean, you know, if you go to meetings, you don't hear a lot of new things. Don't drink, don't use, talk to your sponsor. You know, oh, okay. You hear that for 12 years, it can get a little flat. This guy said, he heard it from his sponsor, each year in recovery gives us 1 second of response time. Okay. So, brand new sober, something happens, boom, you respond. 10 years sober, something happens, you've got 10 seconds. Now, you might make the same stupid decision. but you've been able to think about it for 10 seconds. And I think that's real good. Those early years, I didn't have any response time, and I was so sarcastic, and I was so angry, and I was so hostile. And I see recovery is falling under the sixth and seventh step, regularly asking the higher power to remove the defects of character which stand in the way of our usefulness. And I think slowly over time they can be removed, day at a time, day at a time, day at a time. Let me just say a couple other things, because I don't often hear these talked about at meetings. I was sober a little while, and I was having drinking dreams. And no one was talking about these. And I didn't know what they meant. I mean, does it mean I really want to drink? Does it mean I should rewrite the big book backwards? Does it mean, you know, what does it mean? I've been to meetings where someone said that they've had drinking dreams, and people jumped all over and said, well, you're not working the program hard enough, you know, that which is very helpful. And I think that's crazy, by the way. So I finally asked my sponsor, but I didn't want him to know that I was having drinking dreams. Because. So I think I phrased it like, what does it mean if someone in a different state dreams about drinking? And he said, have you had the one yet? And then he described a dream that was so perverted that I withdrew as from a hot flame. And about 6 months later, I had that dream. You know? And this is the basic form of it, and I think it's very twisted. I'm driving. There is a bottle of Southern Comfort, which I never drank, in a brown paper bag on the passenger seat floor. I lean over, take a hit out of the bottle, and put it back. Now, in real life, I never drank and drove. I drove drunk, but I never drank and drove. For some reason, that was real important. Anyway, that's not the dream. In the dream, I'm drinking and driving, and the thought crosses my mind that I'm speaking at a meeting that night, and that doesn't bother me at all, and my only question is, will any of them smell it? You know? I think that's a pretty perverted dream, and I have it regularly. So what does it mean? What does it mean? And he said two things. Number one, drinking dreams mean that for us, our drinking has become a nightmare. Number two, people who have drinking dreams don't get drunk. He said, did you ever have a drinking dream when you were drinking? Only sober people get them. It's very strange. It's very strange. So that's true. And the other thing is, people have different experience on this. Some people come to a meeting and never think of drinking again for as long as they live, and I'm very happy for them, but that's not my story. I think of drinking a lot. It regularly pops into my brain, and that's because I have an alcoholic brain. Give me a little discomfort, I think of drinking. Give me a little excitement, I think of drinking. Two Christmases ago, I was driving across the Bay Bridge, and I got to the Oakland side, and there was a big sign for Chevy's Mexican Restaurant, and it said, Cranberry Margaritas. I had never thought of a cranberry margarita in my life, but I instantly needed a cranberry margarita so badly that I almost drove into oncoming traffic. And it stayed with me, gnawing on my brain bone for the next 6 weeks. Cranberry margarita, cranberry margarita. And I finally went to a restaurant and ordered a virgin cranberry margarita, and I've only had to have one. But my brain does that a lot. So, you know, what tool do you use? I do this. I don't drink today. When I think of drinking, which is often, I tell myself, Tom, you can drink tomorrow. We just don't drink today. And it takes the edge off. And it gives me a little room, and then I can just worry about it tomorrow. There's a whole lot of things that are going to happen tomorrow. But today, I don't drink, I don't use, and I've got a life that looks like a human life. So I'm real grateful for places like this and rooms like these. And if there's anything I've said tonight that's helpful, I'm glad. And if not, then go to a lot more meetings until you hear something that's helpful. Thanks.